You're listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, Fairfield, Iowa.
This is Icon Art Radio. I'm Bill Teeple. I'm here with Alan Cobb, my co-host, and our guest today is Jim Weidel, who is showing this month at Icon Gallery. And he's a veteran artist and has shown all over the country. He started out doing landscape watercolor. Is that where you kind of got started? Is that the work that first established your reputation in New York City?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Okay.
And it was only within the last 10 years that I thought to try my hand at oil painting, both big scale, large scale, and small scale oil painting, in part due just to the vicissitudes of it, the ungainly aspect of bushwhacking oneself out into Arcadia, because you get all manner of, you're asking for it, because the stuff doesn't dry for days. And it seems to attract all manner of insects. There, look, there's Jim. Come on, over, quick, bring your friends.
Yes, and get the queen.
And what I've learned is don't try to get to remove the insects. Just let them stay and dry. Yeah. And then they just kind of flick away. See, I'm already giving away much coveted
secrets.
Yeah,
these secrets, trade secrets, yeah. Wow.
Trade.
Secrets not known since the Renaissance, when well, honeybees by the thousands would gather in the heavy impastos of Da Vinci until someone realized they should stop using honey as a medium, and it worked out nicely.
Well, the word Renaissance should be an especially attractive segue for a recent book, both recent to me and recent to publication, called The Swerve, written by Stephen Greenblatt. And it's, it is, if I were to summarize, it's a kind of thrill ride back into history, early 1400s, where Greenblatt uses a gentleman from Florence named Poggio, P-O-G-G-I-O, who is a clever fellow, manages to become secretary to the Pope, and has a fondness for illuminated manuscripts and scrolls, and he happens upon De Rerum Natura, to those Latin scholars, already recognized is on the nature of things by Lucretius. And if I have my dates right, it was written a couple hundred AD. But Lucretius, how shall I say, Lucretius' Messiah was probably Epicurus, who was Greek and lived a couple hundred BC, 200-300 BC. And why this should be especially tangy to bring up is through work, admirable work like Mr. Greenblatt, we see that the timeline of history is subject to considerable distortion, subjective and capricious interpretations. And we really probably, it might be safe to say that we probably don't know what happened ever. And to the victor goes the spoils, and also the spin on just exactly what happened.
Well, we don't even know what's happening right now, historically or culturally, let alone what happened 2,000 years ago. So you're right. Go on.
And so what has passed as the overall or the overarching premise or guiding principle of Italian Renaissance was that it was a kind of resurrection of Platonic values, ideas and ideals and ideology, whereas Greenblatt argues persuasively that it was anything but, that it was a reaffirmation of sensuality and materiality, and that is also woven into a fabulous take on Vatican corruption. Those of us who know what shall we call it? Vatican corruption history buffs would know that 1400s was the time of one, if not several, excommunications of popes. A tricky maneuver, surely. But what Poggio observes, probably through Greenblatt, is that in a way it was more representative, a greater fidelity to human nature. And things actually ran rather well, and that there was a level of scholarship and aesthetic achievement within the rubric of what might pass as sins, both venial and mortal. And then Martin Luther came along and in a way, in the Reformation, sort of cleaned up the act to possibly some humanistic detriment. So that's a splendid read.
And in my guess, from my distant point of view in time, is that there was a fluctuation there was the old school and the conservatives, there were probably the new progressives that were embracing, the enjoyment of the world and the senses and all of this. And then there'd be a flip back, probably back and forth, because even in the time of Botticelli, we know that he was embracing this kind of thing, and his paintings expressed this kind of thing. Then suddenly there was this fanatical conservative preacher in Florence, Savonarola, that everybody went the other way. Like, I think they all had a guilt attack until they finally came to their senses and thought, no, we like to embrace the sensuous world, and we're going to put this guy on the stake and get rid of him and go the other way. I think there was this back and forth and fluctuations, probably not only within the church, but within each individual. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to show this tape on Michelangelo's association with a kind of a secret society and his association with the more liberal side of things in the 1500s, mm-hmm. at one of our evenings. So I think it's a fascinating period. And I love the unfoldment of validity, of enjoyment of life. That I love. Mm-hmm. So how did we get here? Where are we going with this conversation?
Well, just where we're going, probably, if we were to simply sequentially proceed, we could go to the 1600s, maybe perhaps to Amsterdam, and find Rembrandt working on a famous painting that now hangs in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, a painting that I was fortunate enough to see last May, Aristotle contemplating the bust of Homer. And I want to speak of that painting is that it's featured in a terrific book, sadly overlooked, by Joseph Heller, written in 1988, called Picture This. And in that book, Joseph Heller manages to, with his patented sort of satire and wit, manages to have us enter and participate in the actual execution of that painting. And it's brilliantly conceived. For example, while he's painting this thing, as soon as Aristotle gets an ear, that is to say, as soon as Rembrandt paints Aristotle's ear, Aristotle can in turn hear what's going on. And then similarly, when he gets eyes painted in, he can observe what's going on. So this is quite imaginative, very novel means of connecting a contretemps, different time periods with the hope of having us recognize that not that much has changed. Business as usual. And why the word business should be so operative is that in Amsterdam, the mid-1600s, we see essentially the birth of capitalism. The Dutch East India Company was a very wealthy and powerful maritime corporation that developed shares for the first time and shareholders for the first time, and they also shipped slaves from Africa to wherever. And I don't think it's entirely inappropriate to combine those two, because with the iteration of early neo-capitalism, you see for the first time a willingness to look the other way and a kind of a hierarchy whereby those who run the operation don't really get their hands dirty. And we could possibly find, since this is a half hour show and there will be, unlike Fresh Air, no magical editing, and that's incidentally what they do, even though it seems so extemporaneous. This was a disclosure by Terry Gross a couple years ago in a book perhaps some of our audiences has read, where they're all over the place, but nevertheless, we just managed to do this because we're extraordinarily skilled and disciplined in our use of words, and I even have some notes, not that I have referred to them at all. In fact, what I have referred to is a drawing pad, and I had the idea. This is a bit of a digression, but you'll see it ties in neatly. I had the idea that I would draw while I was doing this show, because when one draws, certainly when I draw, there's this wonderful three-corner hat that takes place where I am activating the optic nerve and sort of enlivening an angle of contact with the environment that would otherwise be dormant. And I don't know if this is going to happen, but it also reminds me of an idea that I have had floating around for a couple of years. In fact, I even talked to Jimmy Moore about this, and he got dangerously enthusiastic about a show that might even share airtime with Icon Radio. I don't know, we'll see. called Radio Painter. And Radio Painter, this is sort of the rough-hewn sketch, shall we say, of Radio Painter premise. Radio Painter would be me giving painting lessons on the radio to not only household listeners, but busy folk on the highways and byways of life. And I think the idea is so wonderfully loopy that I think that it will surely succeed. It's just a matter of getting, you know, that all-important rough-hewn pilot episode less rough.
Well, we've always felt very inspired by the idea of Dada radio, especially visually oriented radio, which sort of lends itself to the whole idea of Dada, because I just I like the idea of two people talking about a painting and referring to it in visual terms. I especially like the part on the left.
Right. Well, yeah.
Isn't that a lovely color?
It is. It's so, and the way it brings out that feeling of springtime is really quite remarkable, as opposed to this other one over here, which just doesn't get anywhere at all.
It's not unlike what NPR attempted during its pioneer days with little audio background.
Yeah, they seem to have stopped doing that, more or less.
Yeah.
You hear machinery running in the background, and they're talking about the factory, and then you hear a loud smash, and someone shout, ouch, and then they talk about safety on the job, and stuff like that.
Let me just interrupt for a moment to tell our listeners who have just tuned in their car and wonder what is going on, that this is actually Icon Art Radio. The radio show of Iowa Contemporary Art, and we're interviewing Jim Weidel, who is showing right now at Icon Gallery, and we're taking a journey through Jim's mind. This is KRUU 100.1 FM. Continue, boys.
Yeah, well, another writer who I admire very much is Mr. Lewis Hyde, perhaps no stranger to our august members here in the studio, this lavish, exotic studio down Copps. Lewis Hyde wrote in 1979, published in 1983, a seminal bit of beautiful prose called The Gift. He was originally a poet, probably still regards himself as something of a poet. So should he write expositional prose, it has a quality of poetry, a lyrical quality. And his attempt in The Gift, if I were to butcher by way of thumbnail summarization, his attempt is to acknowledge that art, for it to be truly sacred or worthy of its regard and status, as must issue from a gift culture or a gift society. This is in direct and almost collisional contrast to a market culture. And in a market culture, which is our culture, make no mistake.
Surely you jest.
Yeah.
I thought it was a gift culture.
Yeah, I was thinking, gee, everybody's
right. That would be the booby prize culture. Yeah, and it's consolation gift.
It's the everyone is special culture.
Yeah.
Everyone gets a prize, but a prize isn't a gift.
Well, he had to manage quite an acrobatic tightrope act with the gift because he is attempting to affirm the essential. He essentializes art. That is to say, he makes a very original argument that for a society to be truly alive, it must have at its core artistic activity. But artistic activity has no vitality unless it is experienced as an exchange beyond a monetary definition. And if we were to, say, live, for example, in this gift culture, and yes, there are gift cultures, and there have been gift cultures, and every Aboriginal culture is a gift culture, and yes, our culture, yes, our Western culture was originally Aboriginal, therefore gift-oriented. And in fact, when Ben Franklin, good old Ben Franklin, had his encounter with the lightning and the kite, and offered in poor Richard's almanac a patent for a lightning rod, he asked exactly nothing for that invention, and nor did he insist that his name be associated with that invention. And were you to go, say, to Western Europe a little earlier on, and you saw Isaac Newton doing his thing, particularly with color, he was not particularly interested in personal glory in all of his work there and his various other explorations, scientific explorations. So while that may have been true in a culture so secular and so materialistic and so monetarily based that it calls itself literally capitalism or moneyism, we did originally have roots beyond that. And perhaps we can be collectively quixotic at the notion that it could return. I think it has to, for reasons that probably would be testing the limits of our half hour, but were we not to, I think all we would have is more of the same, only more accelerated and more unlivable.
So it's not something you can force on a society. It would take a change from within, a change in consciousness.
It would be an upheaval of our present paradigm. And there's evidence to suggest that an upheaval is in the works.
Well, it almost seems inevitable because the trend seems to be self-reinforcing. And so it's going to reach a tipping point rather than a transition.
Right. Well, some argue from a timeline standpoint that 2008 was the end of what you might call market triumphalism. Mm-hmm. And that will be, whether we want to believe it or not, or whether we are on board with it, will be determined. History will determine mm-hmm. that was the indicator.
And wouldn't you think the polarization that we're experiencing today is kind of this heating up of the end, in a way?
Occupy Wall Street is probably the most glaring or conspicuous manifestation of that, and it's of some interest to anyone who's involved in art that there has become a appendage called Occupy Museum. Some half dozen people back in whatever October of 2011 organized a march on, I believe it was Museum of Modern Art, and it is of interest to know that the Museum of Modern Art has assimilated within fairly recent times what was a gift-oriented manifestation, PS1, back in the early 70s. Possibly some of us remember PS1 as a alternative space. And that is no longer the case. PS1 is just part of the monolithic mothership of Museum of Modern Art. Furthermore, it might be fascinating to point out that a lot of the board members, moguls who sit on the boards of these museums, citadels of art, are precisely the same fellows who orchestrated the meltdown of Wall Street and the Wall Street banks. So that we find ourselves in puny little gnome-like Fairfield suddenly has a refreshing kind of component to it, which is you can scarcely be that participatory of the monolith we encounter with or defined as contemporary Western art. And nor would we necessarily want to be. Yeah, you mentioned earlier, you introduced me as somebody who was involved in the art world, the big bad art world, the New York-based art world. How much time we have?
40 seconds.
40 seconds. But it's kind of nice, actually.
Yeah, we're all in agreement that this place of refuge called Fairfield in between the two big monoliths is a precious spot.
Yeah.
And to say nothing of the ample parking.
That's true. And rush hour only lasts about 5 minutes.
Yeah. Rush minute.
Yeah, rush segment.
Listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.